Lee. I'm going to be your MC for tonight. Although really all I'm doing is acting as the warm-up act for Frank Bongiorno, who will engage Alison Booth in a conversation about the Philosopher's Daughters. Can I begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which I'm speaking to you from today, the Ngunnawal people, Daranuna, Daran Ngunnawal, Yungu, Nalamanyan, Dunimanyan, Ngunnawal Wari, Daro Wari, Dindi, Wangaralinjinyin. I acknowledge any Indigenous people on this conversation tonight. Alison has asked me to kick off by giving you a little taste of her splendid book. So I'm going to read a short extract, and then after that, I'll hand over to Frank Bongiorno. I should say at this point that if you would like to ask a question, you'll need to put it in the chat. So that chat function is the place where you enter your questions, and then Frank will ask them of Alison. So let me begin with an extract. This is early in the book, where we're first being introduced from London to the idea of Australia. "My favourite place is the high country." He began to tell her all about it, his words pouring out as if they'd been waiting for her question, waiting at the ready. Perfectly formed and arrayed in coherent lines, like the bars of music on the sheets in front of them. He told her of the early morning frosts, of waking up to find the fences white and the sunlight slanting through the eucalypts like messages from God. He told her of the smells of the bush and the heat in the middle of the day, even in winter, and the sky a vivid blue and so deep one could drown in it. And then in the evening, the fingers of shadows creeping down the hills from the Brindabella Range, and one by one, the stars appearing. The sky was at first dotted with a sprinkling of them, but as the night wore on, great streamers of stars stretched across the sky, so bright you could travel by night without a lantern, even when there was no moon. If only you could see it, he concluded. Just a taster, and one more reason, if you haven't done so already, to rush out and buy Alison's splendid book. So now, let me hand over to Frank Bongiorno in conversation with Alison Booth.
Great, thank you so much, Andrew. And yes, that's the most important message that must always be delivered on an occasion like this. Go out and buy the book, and I can assure you, you'll enjoy every moment of it. So, look, thank you, Andrew, and welcome everyone, and congratulations to Alison on such a wonderful piece of storytelling, and obviously of great interest to me as a historian, as is all your work. And I really want to begin there, Alison, and to ask you about a historical novel, really, as a form. It's obviously one that appeals to you. This isn't your first historical novel at all. You've written several previously alongside some contemporary fiction. And I just wanted to ask you what attracts you to the historical novel, and also, I guess, whether, you know, there are particular historical novelists or historical novels that have influenced you that you particularly admire.
Well, thank you, Frank. What attracts me to the historic, to writing myself, historical novel, is the fact that I've always loved history. And I actually think that it's probably easier to write an historical novel than to write a current one that might have any politics in it. Because the trouble with the present is you never know quite what's going to happen. And so you can't really capture it. Well, I find I can't really capture it so readily as I can get a handle on the past. But I also love reading history, and the joy about writing historical fiction is that you settle on an issue that you want to explore, and then you can read eclectically around that. And so it's undisciplined in a way. And that's exactly what I did with this book, The Philosopher's Daughters. I decided I wanted to write in the 1890s, and I suspect you'll be asking me a question about that later on, so I won't say why. But once I decided on that, I found that I was just reading everything I could get my hands on to do with the 1890s, in particular to do with the Northern Territory in the 1890s. And of course, once you start writing something, you then have to go and do more research because you realize that you need to know a bit about women's corsets, for example, or about steamers to get to Australia, and then steamers to get from Sydney up to Port Darwin. So, and it goes on. So I find that really attractive. It's a way of escaping into the past. You also asked about, or did you want to say something?
Yeah, well, I mean, the book begins really in Bloomsbury, in you know, that sort of world around Gower Street and so on, and as you say, in the 1890s, but also takes us after the, I guess, the first third of the book to the Northern Territory. And I will obviously come back to Bloomsbury, but I wanted to ask you about the Northern Territory because I understand from your words at the end of the book that there are particular family and personal reasons perhaps why that's of interest to you. But I really wanted to ask you about that Northern Territory setting, which, when we think about Australia in the 1890s, it's not perhaps the Northern Territory that springs to mind. It's a very isolated, Darwin at least, is a very isolated outpost of white Australian society in that period. Also the pastoral stations that you talk about and you evoke their isolation so beautifully. So I really want to ask you more about the Northern Territory as a setting.
Yes. I never thought about the Northern Territory much, in spite of the fact that my father spent 3-4 years up there. He talked about the Northern Territory a lot when we were kids. And you know what kids are like, their parents talk about something and the child turns off and doesn't listen properly. So that was me. And it wasn't until we went up there for the launch of Dad's novel that he wrote called Up the Dusty Track. It was launched at the ANU and also at Charles Darwin University, as it was called then. And it wasn't until I went up then that I saw how beautiful the Northern Territory was. And also I saw that there was a lot of, it struck me the level of racism. So that really got me very, very interested. And then I've got family up there, a sister and brother-in-law living up there, but crucially, my two daughters are both living up there. And they're very interested, very into things like camping and traveling and so on. So we've seen some really wonderful places with them, really wonderful. And I think been rather lucky in that regard, because it really is such a beautiful place. I love the light, I love the colours, and I love the art that the Aboriginal people have produced, just gorgeous. So you could say I fell in love with it on that trip. And then I spent some time figuring out how I could write a novel about the racism that I observed. This was this was 2003, I think, how I could write about that and how best to do it. And so that I started thinking about early colonial times for the territory, early colonial, which was the 1890s. And there was I wanted it to be after the telegraph was constructed, the Overland Telegraph, which has to be one of the biggest engineering works of the 19th century. And that telegraph went from Adelaide up to Port Darwin and then on to Europe underwater. So that had to have been constructed, and that was constructed remarkably quickly. The other reason that I wanted to write in that period was it was pre-Federation, and the Northern Territory in the 1890s was part of South Australia. It was a Northern Territory of South Australia. And you know, just imagine the logistics of administering a colony effectively up there all the way from Adelaide. It's just extraordinary that they did that. So I wanted pre-federation. I wanted to have the frontier wars. I didn't want to have the frontier wars. I wanted to document the frontier wars. And so the 1890s was sensible choice from that perspective. And then I wanted to consider migration, of course. Well, we've got migration all the time from the time the white settler first came here in 1788. So I wanted the migration aspect because these two young women essentially migrated to Australia, although they didn't know that they were going to do that. And then, of course, very importantly, was the women getting the right to vote, Aborigines getting the right to vote as well. Those were issues that really concerned me, because both of these young women were active or interested in the Women's Federation League in Britain, and also very interested in what was happening in Australia. And South Australia, as we know, was one of the most advanced colonies. And it gave women the right to vote in 1894, which was only 1 year after New Zealand and many years before England, before the United Kingdom gave women the right to vote. So that all those things just pushed me into picking 1890s Northern Territory.
But of course, the book doesn't begin in the Northern Territory at all. It begins a long way from there in all sorts of ways, not just physically, but I think, you know, spiritually, really. So I wonder if you could tell us about the Camerons and their world. I've never been to the Northern Territory, I'm ashamed to say, as an Australianist, but I've actually lived in Bloomsbury. So can you tell us a bit about the world of the Camerons in the 1890s, in early 1890s in Bloomsbury?
Yes. Well, I think a lot of people who've travelled to London will have gone to Gower Street, which is where the Camerons were fortunate enough to be living. They lived in one of those lovely old terrace houses, you know, tall and thin. And I lived and worked in near that area for a few years. So I know that area well. And so for me, it was the most natural thing in the world to begin my novel there. And James Cameron, the philosopher, the moral philosopher or political economist of the title, in effect, if I could just say a word about moral philosophy, because any economist who's listening would know that political economy really is a part of moral philosophy. And so I didn't really want to make him an economist. I wanted to make him broader than that, a moral philosopher. And I had in mind someone like John Stuart Mill. I really, really love John Stuart Mill. He wrote that book, which was monograph actually, published in the 1890s called The Subjection of Women. And so I imagined that James Cameron would have written something like that. And he was very concerned. He was a widower. He was very concerned to bring up his daughters a very modern way for the 1890s. And so that was the sort of device I used to make sure that the girls had a relatively modern outlook, so that when, and an intellectual interest in equality for all, that was the driving thing in the Cameron family. And so armed with that sort of education, they were then traveling separately to Australia and to see it in a detached way, but to see it each very differently, which is why I wanted to have the two different perspectives. So you'd get a more nuanced perspective of what the place was like.
Could you say a bit more about the two women that are at the heart of the novel, Sarah and Harriet or Hattie? What kind of women are they? I mean, the book is about It's about the constraints, I think, on women's independence, but also about the worlds that are opening up to them, I guess, in many ways. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about, you know, the kinds of women that, that they are in London in the 1890s and perhaps also in once they come to Australia.
Well, I would like to advise people to read the book to find out what these women were like.
Yes.
But I can say, and I know you have read the book, but I can say that Sarah, who's a younger daughter, and is very musical. She is a very happy individual. She will find happiness everywhere. And her older sister, Harriet, is not. She's a very torn individual, although she doesn't realize that at the beginning of the novel. And in turn, it's a novel in a way about her character development, because she her thinking evolves as she moves through the novel. As I mean, it's not giving the plot away to say that the father dies and he leaves her some money so she can choose not to marry if she doesn't want to. And then she spends a large chunk of the novel. I mean, it's a novel with action, but within that action, she's finding her identity, learning who she is, but she's talented in a number of directions and she wants to use those talents, but she's not quite sure how to use them for the greater good, so to speak.
Well, I mean, she's an interesting and ambivalent character, isn't she, in a lot of ways, because, you know, she is determined at the outset that her commitment, her vocation really is to assist her father. She's gifted in political economy herself, as well as having some gifts in art. And she decides that is her vocation, is essentially to assist her father, which makes her sound dependent in a way, but she's not dependent. She actually is the term you'd use is a formidable character. I mean, she has great independence of mind, a sense of great autonomy, I think, that you evoke with her. So she's a very, how shall I put it, a very difficult character in a way to wrap one's head around, if I could say that.
Yes, she is a complex character. And I think if she'd been born 100 years later, she would have been professor of moral philosophy at University College London, like her father.
Yes.
But she wasn't. She was born at the wrong time. Yes. And so she did engage in writing letters to newspapers and so on. But it's not quite the same as being an academic, but it's a way of being very, very active. Mm. And she has a very caustic sort of wit, I suppose you'd call it. She's quite sharp in some ways. And so Sarah, her younger sister, has to balance that out, smooth over the edges of that to some degree.
Yeah. As I think Andrew's extract at the beginning, the extract Andrew read out at the beginning underlines, I mean, the book is about the beauty and the lure of the Australian landscape. But you also evoke the landscape as a place, I think, of danger and particularly of danger for women. And I was sometimes reminded of an author who was active actually really in roughly in the period that you're writing about, Barbara Bainton, and her evocations of the bush as a place that's dangerous to women. And I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, it's a balance that I think is again at the heart of the Australian sections of the novel, that Australia is a place of great beauty, and you emphasise the distinctiveness of the light. That's a recurring theme, but at the same time, it's a dangerous place, and particularly, I think, in terms of sexual danger. So I wonder if I could ask you to talk a little bit about again that kind of ambivalence about landscape, I think, in this case.
Yes, it's, I mean, I think that is sort of a theme of the book, really, the balance between the confined spaces of inner London, Gower Street, and then these vast spaces, uncharted spaces, with infinite possibilities in Australia, and the balance that young the path that young women have to tread, and I think that still applies now, that young women of that age group have to tread that path very carefully, because there's still male predators around. And so it's always, for women of that age group, a danger that they have to deal with. And Sarah reacts to the dangers in the outback in a pretty cool sort of way, by learning how to shoot, and she discovers she's very good at it.
It's a Calamity Jane type feel, she seems to just have a natural gift for being able to shoot accurately at these tin cans and things, yeah.
Well, my mother was actually rather a good shot with a rifle, but when she was young, I should hasten to say. Yes, she's a bit like that. And then for Harriet, the dangers of the bush, she wasn't quite as alert as her younger sister was to what could go wrong. Although she was very alert to the terrible treatment of the Aboriginal population on the adjacent station, which was just appalling. And I have to say that violence on the adjacent station, which was never sort of directly reported in the book, I don't want people to be put off by that violence, really. It's always reported, not quite as through a veil, but it's reported with someone talking about it, which is a way for a reader to distance themselves slightly from it. So it's not so, traumatic to read. And in fact, that violence at the adjacent station was something that I wouldn't have been able to think that up for myself. I saw that in a book that I read, that was what happened, which was pretty horrifying.
Mm. I mean, it's also, of course, how the violence worked in a way in the territory, according to story and to rumour. So-and-so heard it from so-and-so. It's very much a part of the way in which violence against Indigenous people by white people worked in that society in the late 19th and early 20th century.
Yes, that's a very good point, Horrifying.
It is indeed. Now, this is one I'm sure that you will have been asked many times, and I'm sure it's a question that all novelists hate. It's really to ask, I guess, about the autobiographical dimensions of a novel. I mean, we can't help notice that Harriet is indeed a political economist, as well as being a creative artist, not a novelist, but a painter. And in a sense, the book is about the development, I think, of her creativity in a way. She needs to not reject, but certainly to move beyond the particular confined spaces, as you called them earlier, of Bloomsbury, including perhaps the confined spaces of the intellectual and political worlds that she belonged to within her family and those circles in London, to move beyond that kind of rationality. And I wondered there, is there resonance in your own experience of working as both an economist and a writer? You write as an economist too, of course, so, they're not necessarily, totally different exercises, but I wondered about the relationship between those two aspects of your own work and whether, there are dimensions of that in particular in Harriet's experience.
Yes, is a short answer. Do you want a short answer to you? You want a longer one?
I do indeed, yeah.
Yes, well, maybe I've got a bit confused about my identity, but also on the other hand, I do think that it's rather unfortunate about our times that we are channeled into one thing and we stay in that one thing, when in fact we might like to move sideways a bit and have a little bit of this and a little bit of that. Actually, I rather envy you historians, because I think you have a freer sort of approach. Of course, you may not have the rigor that we economists like to think that we have, but you have that breadth that we don't necessarily have. So I think I've been very privileged in that I've been able to do both in my lifetime.
And you know, again, I'm sure this is a question that you've been asked before, but I mean, the writing you do as a novelist, does that prompt you to look at your work as an economist and to perhaps do your work as an economist in different kinds of ways?
That's a very good question, and I've never thought of it like that. I think it's probably improved my writing as an economist, but the actual issues that I look at, well, I've always been interested in psychological issues as an economist, and social issues as well, and they feed through into novel writing as well. When you're developing characters, you're looking at psychology, and so that relates to the work that I've done and doing in economics. So I think they're very much complementary, and it may be that I've become more interested in economic psychology since writing about character development. It's rather hard to say which came first.
Great, thanks. That's really fascinating, absolutely fascinating. Now, I've still got a couple more questions, Alison. You probably won't be relieved to hear.
I'm enjoying your question.
Well, I'm enjoying it very much too. What I'd like to do now is to call on Andrew again to read another extract from the novel. Over to you, Andrew.
Thanks, Frank. I do feel as though my role here is a bit of the nature of the musical interlude part way through the evening, but at the very least, giving Alison's voice a break and giving you another taste of this wonderful book. This is from about halfway through the book. After dinner that evening, Harriet wandered out into the garden, through which moonlight poured, turning to shades of indigo and silver the foliage that by daylight had seemed green and gold. The air was heavy and scented with flowers that were unknown to her. Three purling luggers, solid shapes in the shimmering water, were moored not far from the mangrove-edged shoreline. She sat on one of the chairs on the lawn and listened to the distant shouts from the crew of one of the luggers. Presently, she heard the haunting sound of a didgeridoo, which seemed to be coming from the direction of Mindle Beach. Its reverberations so deep, she could almost feel its vibrations. The didgeridoo was joined by a rhythmic beating of what could be wooden sticks. After a time, the mournful voice started to chant, a chanting that continued for some minutes in a restricted range of a couple of notes, until it suddenly rose in a whooshing sound, almost like the cry of some startled animal, before settling back to its original narrow range of sounds, accompanied all the while by the didgeridoo and beating sticks. The voice was articulating words in a language she could never hope to understand. The chant was almost hypnotic, for it made her want to tap her foot, and then to stand up and move, to stand up and dance. So she did that after a while. She got up out of her chair and stamped around the lawn. And as she danced, she moved out of herself and looked down on herself. A tiny figure on the lush lawn of the government residency in this tiny settlement next to the Arafura Sea, on an isolated continent, on a planet spinning through space, for she had been well educated in science and by nature and nurture, was aware of the insignificance of man. as she danced and contemplated the vastness of space and the unimportance of man, it didn't occur to her that she might ever find this frightening. Back to you, Frank.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Andrew. I should mention that Andrew will shortly be going off to Anthony Albanese's budget reply speech, and I really hope that that speech, as well as Anthony Albanese's delivery of it, is as poetic as what we just
I have many aspirations for it, Frank, but we're not aiming as high as Alison's prize.
Thank you, Andrew. Thanks so much. The wonderful flavour of a terrific novel. And look, what I want to do now, Alison, is really turn to, I guess, you know, a theme that is so central to the novel, and that is race and racism, as you've already mentioned. And, you know, the novel's pervaded by those issues. And it deals with the relationship between an Indigenous man and a white middle-class woman. Not a common one, I think, in literature, at least until recently, Australian literature, at least until recently. Relations between white men and Indigenous women, of course, have been rather more covered. One thinks of, you know, Catherine Susanna Pritchard's Coonadoo in the 1920s, and there are other examples. Well, I guess I wanted to ask you about that, the challenges of dealing with that kind of relationship, of dealing with a world that's, you know, both violent in a way, but also based on intimacy. So, you know, how did you manage those, again, those kind of, I guess, you know, very challenging, you know, different strands of reality, I guess?
Yes. Thank you, Frank. That's a very good question and a difficult one to answer. When I started this novel, this is the one that's taken longest to write of all my novels, because of the difficulty of that issue, how to deal with that in a sensitive way, and also how to deal with it in a way that's appropriate to our times and to readers of the times. And in the 17 years since I first had the idea for this book, attitudes have changed a lot. And so too the novel evolved to deal with those issues. And the ending of the book also changed a lot. And that last chapter, I had that in very early on, and then I took it out, and then I put it back in, and then I took it out. It's a bit like Oscar Wilde with his commas, you know, he puts one in the morning, takes it out in the afternoon, and he'd had a good day's work. So I basically what I did with that was I trod very carefully. And the character that the character with whom she becomes friendly, Harriet Mick, who's a stockman at the station, he comes from the Kuyong area, I should say, in the bottom of South Australia, and he was mission educated, and he worked his way up South Australia, Northern Territory, and ended up on this cattle station. And that's how they met. And he is hugely intelligent. And I had a lot of fun with that character, actually, but I should also mention that this novel is written only from the points of view of the two young women. This is an area where one wants to tread very carefully, because I wouldn't want to attempt to write from the point of view of an Indigenous person. We've taken so much from them already without taking their stories. But I wanted to have, to explore that possibility of a relationship with someone about which there are so many taboos in society at that time. And so that basically an answer to your question, it took a very long time. Mm-hmm. And I had to tread very carefully.
Yeah.
Actually, I did have fun with him because he has a sense of humor. And when she first spoke to him, he was speaking in pidgin and he was pretending he couldn't speak any English of the sort that she was used to. But in fact, he speaks English perfectly. And it took a while for them to realize that what he was doing is a sort of a joke and how to move away from that.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, that question brings us almost back to the very first one I asked you about, you know, the genre of the historical novel. I was really interested in what you said there, Alison, about the story needing to be meaningful for your audience, your present audience. You know, you're not necessarily, historical realism isn't the only aim of the game, is it, in a novel of this kind? It's a kind of, you know, as we historians sometimes say, a conversation, isn't it, between the past and a present, really. And it must have been incredibly challenging to produce something that would be, you know, credible within the context of a historical novel, and yet also speak to a contemporary audience and to the sensibilities, I suppose, of that audience. So I can kind of see why it would, you know, be such a difficult thing to do. I mean, it kind of brings me to my last question, though, is where your writing is going to take you next. Are you already working on another novel? And, is it going to be more historical fiction?
Well, before I answer that, you said you were going to ask me a question about why I chose that title for the book.
Oh, the book, yes, I didn't ask you that. The Philosopher's Daughters, yes. Yes, we sort of got lost when I was asking you about what the two women were like, really. It's an interesting choice, isn't it, given the themes of the novel around, obviously the relationship, especially of Harriet to her father, and the whole theme, I guess, of women's independence and so on. So, yes, the title. Could you say a little bit about that?
Yes, I'd be delighted to. Originally, I had the title as On the Wrong Side, and I came up with that because of what I think might be a Jewish saying. I'm not sure about that, but it was basically about the immigrant, that once you cross the ocean, you are always on the wrong side. And I thought the wrong side would be quite nice to reflect that, but also to reflect the fact that there was this sort of frontier war stuff going on. And which side are you on? Always the wrong one. But anyway, other people weren't as keen on that title as I was. And then I thought of Dimble at Downs. but that sort of conjures up somewhere that's like Britain or lush like Queensland, and where in the territory where Dimble at Downs is not at all lush, and it's basically a collection of corrugated iron sheds. So that one went out the door. And then lastly, we had I thought of the professor's daughters, but then that's obviously too autobiographical. So then it became the philosopher's daughters. And there's some people think that, you know, having someone, it's not really all that feminist to, you know, talk about the philosopher's daughters when basically the novel is about the daughters, not about the philosophers. But the good thing about a title like that is that it positions the story. So while it may not be a strong sort of feminist thing, it's a way of showing to the potential reader that this is where those young women are.
It also struck me, it does capture something very important, I think, certainly on my reading of the novel, that they don't reject their father's world, do they? They, in a sense, they carry the same egalitarian values to Australia and extend them, because they're confronted with this, as you point out, this vicious racism on the frontier, and they continue to apply the same principles, the same ideas fostered in Gower Street at Dimboola Downs.
Yes, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so
they're true to their values.
Yeah. Oh, the next one. Does it have a working title? where do you go next?
Yeah, the next one does have a working title. And it's called The Painting. And it's set in Sydney and Budapest in the late 1980s, just before the fall of the Berlin Wall. Excuse me, I'm just going to have a drink of water. And it's about a young, traumatized Hungarian migrant, Annika, who comes to Australia with an impressionist painting that she's been given. And then she has it evaluated. She thought it was Hungarian, it turns out to be French. And then she wonders where on earth it came from, what was its provenance. And then in exploring that, she is confronted with her family's past and secrets from her family's past. And so that's the basic story.
Sounds wonderful, Alison. It's on the 1980s, which is one of my favourite periods too. So I very much look forward to it. I hope we're sitting here actually in about a couple of years' time talking about it. Look, we've got to just after 7:10. I thought we perhaps open for questions. So if you've got any questions you'd like to ask of Alison, if you could just slip them into the chat box and then I'll relay them to Alison for her to answer. So over to our audience. You always sort of, I do that in fear because you think, oh God, we're not going to have silence now, are we? So don't let us down, folks. I'm sure there's plenty of things to talk about. Do we have any questions from our audience? Fire away. If not, I'll just keep asking questions. Do we have anyone? Well, I'll continue to ask questions then, Alison, and perhaps we'll give people a bit more time to see if they've got anything that they'd like to ask. In terms of obviously, art is one of the things that's very important to this novel. I mean, it's not just that Harriet is herself an artist who clearly has talent, but is also conscious, I guess, of not having achieved the excellence that, you know, clearly is very much her standard. And it's not just the Australian landscape, is it, that brings that out of her. It is the relationship, her sister to some extent, which changes enormously in the territory. But you know, also relationship with her Aboriginal partner, I guess, as he becomes. Could you perhaps say a little bit about that? I mean, the sense in which her encounter with the landscape is very much mediated by him, as I understand it.
She sees it very much as an impressionist painter looking at light. Whenever she sees something, she sees it in the form of light. And whereas when she realized that the stockman also has a view of the landscape, it's in terms more of the structure of the pathways of the shapes of things, it's very different from her own. But hers is very much is very much the developing European impressionist perspective of the time. And so it wouldn't really have mattered whether she did that in London or whether she did it in Australia, except that you get rather better colours in Australia than you might in the wet Gower Street environment.
Great. Okay, well, look, we've got some questions coming through now. So I've got one from Lisa. And then, have you always written fiction, Alison? When did you start and how did you start, before or after becoming an economist?
Well, the first novel I wrote was when I was in primary school, when we had a really wonderful teacher who, in creative writing or composition as it was called then, she decided that we would write, each lesson we would write a chapter of a book. And so we did that, and I still have mine actually somewhere. It's very much in the Arthur Ransom, Swallow and Amazons genre. So that's when I started, and then I didn't do anything much until I started in the started to write short stories, which is all I could fit in with my life. And then writing short stories is incredibly hard. And a friend of mine who was actually Deborah Mabbott, she was at that British launch of my book a few weeks ago. She said, well, why don't you just write a novel? And I said, well, isn't that terribly difficult? And she said, oh, you just sit down at the beginning and you keep writing. Little did I know. Yes, so that's how I started, and then discovered that I loved doing it, and it just carried on.
Great. Thanks, Alison. Now, I've got another one here from Arthur. What are some of the, hi, Alison, what are some of the current debates that you think the book has resonance for?
Well, I think it has resonance for Me Too and hashtag Me Too and hashtag Black Lives Matter, resonance for both.
And I've got another question. This one's from Kay, that basically asks, were you thinking about Black Lives Matter or the Black Lives Matter movement when writing? Some of the notions are very current.
No, because I finished writing the book before that emerged in the public mind.
Right, yes. And I've got another, so it's Stephen asking about parallels with Saltwater Creek. Not sure about that one. I might come back to that in a moment. Tina, I've got here. Your books often portray characters who have a European connection. Are you considering exploring other parts of the world? Well, I think we've already had one answer to that. The next one is partly about Europe. Does this appeal to your interest in history?
Does.
Exploring other parts of the world other than the European connection, does that appeal to your interest in history?
Well, yes, very much. But it would be a huge amount of work. It would be a fabulous thing to do, but it would be a huge amount of work. And I think it would be very hard for me to, although hang on, why not? I could write something about set in Hong Kong, could do that, or set in colonial India. That would be a challenge. Why not? Yes.
Glad to hear it. We would love to read your. Oh, here we go. We would love to read your first novel written in primary school. Now, Lucy Neve is asking, hi, Alison. It's great to hear you talking about your novel. I'm wondering about the settings of your novels and how you think about the relationship between the setting and narrative. Okay, so the relationship between the setting and the narrative.
Yes, the relationship between the landscape and the narrative. Yes, it's very close to my mind. I feel... I mean, there's a sense in which the landscape is, there's a certain transcendence about the landscape, to my mind. I know that not everybody thinks of it like that, but that's how I think of it. I find it very, it's the nearest thing I could get to a god, the landscape. It's certainly transcendental. So that's very important to me. But in this particular novel, the landscape was important, not only because of Harriet being an artist, but also because of the fact that it was very dangerous. And so that was important to the novel and the characters and the plot as well.
Great. It's just dawned on me what that's saying. We would love to read your first novel written in primary school, Love from Your Daughters. There you go. Oh dear.
I'll share it to you, darling.
Wonderful. Now, we've got one here from Kerry. Good to hear about the historical setting. Could you talk more about the opportunities for making history accessible?
In the opportunities for making history accessible in a novel?
I guess in the context of a novel, perhaps, yeah.
Well, that's a good point, that novels can make history much more accessible. And it's a fun way of picking up some history, I guess. Yes, it is. I think it's a good way of making history accessible. What do you think, Frank?
Very much so. I mean, I spent ISO, as they call it these days, reading the Hilary Mantel trilogy, which I'd never read. This is the Wolf Hall trilogy from Go to Woe, which must be a couple of thousand pages, I suppose, across the three novels. And I was very struck by the fact that, you know, I don't think I could ever quite see politics in the same way again. I mean, she creates this incredibly compelling embodied figure across, you know, all those pages. And you know, as a historian, I mean, it's not my period, I can't comment on, I know it's well regarded by historians, but it just struck me that, you know, she was saying things that resonate for me as someone, you know, interested in who researches and writes history. And again, the same with yours, Alison, that I'll never be able to think about the Northern Territory again in quite the same way because of the way you evoke both place and period. And I think novels, it seems to me, do have a power to do that. Doesn't mean that there's something deficient about history, but they are different genres. And there are different disciplines operating, I guess, in the two instances.
Mm. Yes.
I mean, do you read still a lot of history yourself?
I've been reading some Budapest history, and I studied history at school. I was very interested in it. And I read, as I need to, I read the history now. So when I'm doing research, when I've got an idea for a book, I go and read the history. And sometimes I know the book won't work, so I stop reading that particular bit of history and I go and read another book. Bit. I also read quite a few historical novels. So I read the first two of Hilary Mantel, and I read the first, a third of the last one, and I still haven't finished it. I find it rather daunting. It's rather long.
Very long.
Very long. Yeah.
It must be about 800 pages. It is the longest of the three. Yes. So now I've got others have come in. How does a story come to feel like one you have to tell? There are so many possible stories that you must tarry with. How does one start to grow? What's the process?
I think it relates to obsession, that you have an idea and it won't leave you alone and you become obsessed by it. And so you just have to continue. That's what I find. And I think a lot of academics are very obsessive people, and I've got that characteristic.
I've got another one from Kerry here. I guess this is one we've touched on already, and it is one of the tough issues for you as a novelist in this instance. How did you gain the nuances of mixed character?
Of
mixed characters.
Yes.
Is our for those who are watching, just a reminder, Aboriginal stockman.
Yes, how did I gain the nuances of his character? Well, always I'm an outsider looking in. It's never from his point of view. So it's like gaining, well, put it this way, everybody's equal. You gain the nuances of the character from their expressions, from their appearance, from talking to them and so on. It doesn't matter whether black, white, yellow, whatever. It's if you're not writing from their perspective, it's a matter of observing them as characters, as like a psychologist or like a friend or somebody who is just chatting to them. So that's how I did that with mixed character. Plus the fact that I've seen quite a few Indigenous people, and so that it's possible to describe appearances.
And that last one actually was from Paulina, and I have one here following from Paulina's question. Does mixed character have any links to the strong Indigenous and also humorous man in Stormboy? Yes, I thought of him too, given that Nick is from the Purong. Yeah, so were there any links there to that story?
No. Oh. But I must go and watch the new film. Was that the old film or the new film, I wonder? Or the book?
Yeah, I guess both, really. I mean, his character in both the new and old films, I guess, yeah.
But actually, that could, his appearance is somewhat like that, yes. Mm. Yeah, that's a bit of a...
Now, I've got another one here. Franny Ellison, sounds wonderful. I'll buy a copy for myself and for both of my two daughters. It sounds to be a novel that would translate into an excellent film.
I quite agree. With a filmmaker watching this.
Let's hope. I think it'd be a wonderful story for film. Justine is saying both the films and the book in terms of Stormboy. Yeah. Okay. Are there any more questions? I think we've just about questioned out. So, and we are very close to 7:30. So, Andrew having to head off, our chair having to head off to the House of Representatives. I have the task of closing off tonight, and I'd like to do that obviously by thanking Katerina from Harry Hartog Books for all that she's done to organise and to promote tonight's event. To everyone in the audience, of course, for your participation, and especially for your questions at the end, which were fascinating and extended the discussion in all sorts of interesting directions. I'd like to thank Andrew as chair. Most of all, of course, I'd like to thank Alison for being a wonderful person to talk to tonight, to thank her for the book, which is, as I said, a marvellous read. I'm going to wave my copy in front of the screen. Available, I should imagine, from Harry Hartog Books, as well as other good booksellers in Canberra and elsewhere. So please head off as soon as you can to buy a copy. You won't be disappointed. It's a wonderful, compelling story. And without further ado, once again, just to ask you to thank and congratulate Alison on her book and on her conversation tonight. So thank you very much to everyone.
I'd like to thank everyone too. Thank you.
Great.
Can I just say thank you to everyone who turned up? It was really lovely to have hi friends there. And thank you so much. And thank you, Frank. That was great to talk to you.
It was a pleasure. Thanks, Alison. It was lovely to talk to you too. Great. Okay. I'm getting all sorts of thank yous over there in the chat box. Yeah,
that's really nice.
Yeah. Well, I can't wait for the next one. That sounds wonderful. It was in the late 1980s. Yeah.
Yes, that